Back a couple of decades ago, in the 50s, social trends are so different. I cut out a clipping out of the Calgary Herald just about board games. Remember, we used to spend hours playing Monopoly, Scrabble, Steeplechase, and whole Sundays would go by. But right now, epic games that could take that much time are becoming a thing of the past, and they're trying to get everything over in 20 minutes. Play Monopoly in 20 minutes. They said about 750 people used to play Monopoly, but now times have changed. The attention spans are much less. Our lives are more hurried. We don't seem to have the time for those things. And a four-hour epic Monopoly involved nothing but dice and a piece of cardboard. It's become a time of the thing of the past, and manufacturers now are going to faster games to try to keep so they can be played much quicker than they used to be. Times have changed. I got another clipping. These are all recent. This is out of the Calgary Herald, Daytona Beach, Florida. A homeless day laborer was recovering in a hospital Friday after two 10-year-old boys and an older boy attacked him on a street and smashed a concrete block in his face. Two 10-year-old boys. Those things were unheard of. And then when the three boys went to court, no parents were in the courtroom during the boys' first appearance before a judge. Cut out another clipping. This is from a Newsweek magazine entitled Girls Gone Bad. And the headline is Paris, Brittany, Lindsay, and Nicole. They seem to be everywhere, and they seem to be wearing underwear. They may not be wearing underwear. Tweens adore them, and teens envy them. But are we raising a generation of prostitutes? And a full-length article on that, written by Kathleen Devaney and Raina Kelly. In that article in Newsweek, this came out February 12th, just last month, 2 months ago, never before our kids are being bombarded by images of oversexed, underdressed celebrities who can't seem to step out of a car without displaying their well-waxed private parts to photographers. Videos like Girls Gone Wild or Camp on Campus Uncensored bring in $40 million. The authors went on in the article to say that 77% of Americans believe that Brittany, Paris, and Lindsay have too much influence on young girls now. They asked the question in the article, where do our children learn their values? Here's a radical idea at home, where they always have. Experts say attentive parents, strong teachers, and nice friends have an excellent counterbalance to our increasingly sleazy culture. And study after study shows that parents and the home environment can outweigh these things. Further on in this same article, they said, we begin to teach our kids values when they're still in diapers. Kids learn good morals and values by copying role models who they are close to, says Michael Borba, author of Teaching Moral Intelligence. Experts say that even the most withdrawn teen scrutinizes their parents for clues on how to act. So that's encouraging. I was over at my daughter and her husband's place not too long ago, and I was looking at the McLean's magazine. This is January 1st, 2007. And there's an article in there, actually an interview with Celia Riverbark. She is a columnist and an author of Stop Dressing Your Six-Year-Old Like a Shank. And in the interview, she talks to Kenneth White. Subhead of the article, it says, your kids say that's the way they look on TV, and it's not a scuzzy show, but they still end up looking like hookers. Struggle that some parents have now with role models and what some of our young people see in the media. She talks in the interview about the question is right. So some guy who sees it as an invitation, you know, as far as the way some of the young girls dress, oh yeah, because they're out there. But again, I don't blame the kid. I blame the parent for buying those kind of clothes. Parents can say no. Another question, does this genie get put back in a bottle? She said it goes back to the child-centered home household. She said, we've lost the notion as parents that it's really okay to be grown up and to say no to your kids. She said, my daughter hears it all the time. Occasionally she hears yes, but she also hears a lot of no's. There was a dress she wanted a couple of months ago, and she had a real meltdown wanting it, and I thought the dress was inappropriate. And we all survived it. Parents almost think that it's in their contract that they have to negotiate. Well, no, they don't really have to. Some things maybe, but not everything. If your kid is trying to get out of the house looking like a mattress back, then you just send the kid right back in there and have them try again. You know, dress according to the standards of the household. And they talk about Nelly Furtado. What's that song? Promiscuous? Yeah. Well, I guess, question, I guess we're leading exporter of shank music. And her answer, who would have thought, yeah, that song will come on my daughter's favorite radio station. And I'm like, no, I turn it off. Question, you turn off your daughter's radio? Answer, oh yeah, when that comes on, I do. I don't think it's appropriate for a 9-year-old to be singing along to how promiscuous she is. I mean, I don't even know if she knows what the words mean, but it's just a little early for that, don't you think? Of course, I'm a realist. I know that when she hits 13, 14, and 15, and she lives on with her iPod, her ears glued to it. I understand that's inevitable, but she's 9 years old, barely nine. I don't want her singing how promiscuous she is. And then, well, there's other questions, but she's a well-known columnist writing for a lot of papers. Anyway, I think times have changed. We're living in a different world, and it's been, I think, a while since I covered anything on parenting. I thought with the DVD presentation today, plus my mind been immersed on kids last few days. We were at the TELUS Science Center yesterday. Had the pleasure of going there with my two grandchildren. And first time my wife and I have been there, and it's just a wonderful place to go. Our daughter said, boy, she wished that they had something like that in Kelowna. Heidi recommended it. She says she has a season's pass, and a great way to spend time with your kids, your grandkids. And what a joy to see young families there just celebrating quality time with their kids. I was at the airport on Thursday waiting for my daughter Tammy and Jason, son-in-law, to arrive. And it's nice to just kind of watch people at airports because they're the last ones with small children, you know, get off last. And maybe because of the Easter weekend, there are a lot of connections between children and grandparents. And just wonderful sights of little children running to their grandparents or grandparents, hugging them and weeping tears of joy. Wonderful to see that. Here in Calgary, we're blessed with a fair number of young couples. Here in Calgary, we're blessed with a good group of young people. And I thought it would be good to cover a few things along this line. Scriptural basis, maybe have a disclaimer that I think my only claim to be able to even talk about parenting and child rearing is the fact that we raised a couple of girls ourselves, and they're not in jail. They're not druggies. They're respectable, and we love them very deeply. Plus the fact that we're grandparents, but also in the ministry, you address issues or topics that are addressed by the Bible. And family and parenting and the issues with children have a wide scriptural base. It's not my intention to go through all the scriptures, but just a few fundamental scriptures is embedded in the Ten Commandments. One of the commandments has to do with home life, with parents, children, relationship. And you know I'm talking about the fifth one in Exodus 20 and verse 12, where we're told to honor our father and our mother, that our days may be long upon the land which the Lord God gives us. And it's a lifelong thing. Even when our parents pass away, we still honor and treasure the memory of them. Also in Titus chapter 2 and verse 4, a beautiful scripture addressed, this is addressed to young women with children. It says, Titus chapter 2 and verse 4, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, and to love their children. I think most women do. But again, we're encouraged to continue to do that. And in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, it says, and you fathers, this is directed to fathers, it says, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. It takes two to successfully raise children. It can be done by single parent, and I've seen good examples of that, but it's more of a challenge because a single parent tries to fill both roles, and this parenting has to be one of the most toughest challenges I think anybody ever goes through. I think of Janina when she shows up here and how happy she is to have relief and hand over her little Elijah. She says, I'm free, and enjoy some freedom because you're bound 24/7. It's just such a time-consuming job, and it's so important. And the Bible talks about the beauty of home life and family life. We're familiar with Psalm 128, especially in verse 3, where it talks about how your wife shall be a fruitful vine by the sides of your house, and your children like olive plants round about your table. It's a beautiful, picturesque scene of a close family cohesiveness. You know, spiritually, we have the analogy of how God is our Father. Jesus Christ is our elder brother. It's a family relationship. The church is our spiritual mother. So I entitled the sermon this afternoon, Parenting in the 21st Century. I think it's a little different than it was parenting in the 1950s. And we can probably go on and share a lot of stories, what it's like to grow up. I grew up in the 50s. Compared to what it is like for kids to grow up now. Times have changed. But all we can do is just scratch the surface. It's such a huge topic. Tidbits I've accumulated in different files for things. You kind of let sermons hatch and build over time. As you see material come your way, you just kind of stick it in a file and let it kind of begin to grow. And when the file is thick enough, then you can give a sermon on it. So that's the way it develops sometime. But basically, just an encouragement for all the parents to, keep on keeping on. It's a tough job. And perhaps you might be able to refine some skills, maybe get some, more ideas, or be reinforced that I am doing it right. Because sometimes, parenting is probably one of the most guilt-ridden things we do, because we feel we're never good enough. We never feel we do enough, and it probably nags us throughout our days. Even when our kids have grown up and left, you discuss, well, if I'd done that better, if I'd done that better, or whatever. So that's, I'm sure most of us, most parents would feel that way. I see at least one head. Nice to see the Blairs here sitting in the front row. It shows how quickly time goes. We bring our grandchildren here, and Ernie and Dawn remember our daughter at that age. Yeah, so that seems like yesterday. Man, where do the years go by? So, it's just no particular order of priority. Actually, I'd probably say the most important for the end of the sermon. But again, to show how times have changed, here's this is author unknown, wrote this short piece. It says, the other day, someone at our store in our city read that a meth lab had been found in the old farmhouse in the adjoining county, and he asked me a rhetorical question. Why don't we have a drug problem when you and I were growing up? Do you remember drugs in the 50s? The big thing I remember in the 50s is you used to, try to smoke a cigarette behind the woodshed or somewhere. That was the only drug problem that I knew of. I replied, I had a drug problem when I was young. I was drugged to church on Sunday morning. I was drugged to church for weddings and funerals. I was drugged to family reunions and community socials, no matter the weather. I was drugged by my ears when I disrespected adults. I was drugged to the woodshed when I disobeyed my parents, when I told a lie, brought home a bad report card, did not speak with respect, spoke ill of the teacher, or if I didn't put forth my best effort in everything that they asked me of me. I was drugged to the kitchen sink to have my mouth washed with soap if I uttered a profane four-lettered word. I was drugged to pull weeds out of mom's garden and flower bed and cocker burrs out of dad's fields. I was drugged to the homes of family, friends, neighbors to help out some poor soul who had no one to mow the yard, repair the clothesline, or chop firewood. And if mother had ever known that it took a single dime for a tip for that kindness, she would have drugged me right back to the woodshed. These drugs are still in my veins, and they affect my behavior in everything I do and say and think. They are stronger than cocaine, crack, or heroin. And if today's children had this kind of drug problem, Canada would be a better place. I guess probably some would say amen. Times have changed. We're living in a time of everything has to be politically correct. Every time I do a wedding now, sometimes you hear the word respect or obey, and some it's not even politically correct sometimes for a woman to say that she'll obey her husband. So how do we get around some of those biblical principles or laws? This is not really to do with child rearing, but it shows how times have changed in so many areas in our society today. Here's I had this in my file. A Southern Baptist pleads with churches to recover some Bible-based discipline. This particular church pastor said it's rare nowadays for a pastor to attempt to bar or discipline a lay member. U.S. congregations largely ignore the Bible's teachings about discipline, and the result is the imploding collapse of authentic Christianity in this generation, asserts Reverend R. Albert Moeller Jr., president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, in a series of internet articles. Fearing lawsuits and lacking courage, congregations allow sin to go unconfronted and heresy to grow unchecked, he lamented. One reason for this situation, he wrote, is churches' creeping accommodation to American culture and moral individualism. Individualism now claim an enormous zone of personal privacy and moral autonomy. He said the trend is reinforced, he said, by the culture's claim that people no longer sin. but rather need therapy, make poor choices, fail to live up to expectations, or are inadequately self-actualized. During the days of unleavened bread, if you're totally politically correct, you wouldn't even want to be talking about sin, because you don't hear too much about it in a lot of churches anymore. Another clipping, this is kind of interesting. This is from Newsweek magazine, February the 5th, just a few months ago, 2007. A new study of more than 2,000 parents in the journal Clinical Pediatrics found fewer than 9% explicitly admit to spanking their children ages 2 to 11. While at the same time, 40% say they were spanked as a child and use the same discipline teaching as their parents. Sometimes they get a little bit of double talk with some of these surveys they've taken. National surveys in 1975 and 1985 found that more than 90% of parents spanked their three-year-olds. In 1988, two-thirds of mothers with children under six said they routinely hit their child three times a week. By the 1990s, however, it was widely agreed in the medical community that corporal punishment does not work, is less effective than other discipline techniques, and has potential harmful side effects. Interestingly, this is in brackets, a third of parents in the new survey say their discipline approach is ineffective. Another article, this is from Focus on the Family, April 1998. This is a controversial issue, and it's an individual judgment call. But again, there are scriptures on it, just like there are scriptures on every aspect as far as parenting. But this is from the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine. There was a study done by Dr. Marjorie Gounod concluded for most children, claims of spanking teaches aggression seems unfounded. Opposition to spanking has been growing in elite circles over the last 15 years. And then the article went on. This is actually written by Dr. Trumbull. He's a pediatrician in a private practice in Montgomery, Alabama, and also co-authored by Dr. Raviel. He's a pediatrician in private practice in High Point, North Carolina, and a member of the Focus on the Family's Physicians Resource Council. And in this short article, they take some of the arguments and they rebuttal them. They say there is no evidence that a mild spank to the buttocks of a disobedient child by a loving parent teaches a child aggressive behavior. And another statement they make, when effective spanking is removed from a parent's repertoire, he or she is left with nagging, begging, belittling, yelling once the primary measures have failed. And then another point they made, excessive scolding and berating of a child is emotionally harmful. Excessive use of isolation for unreasonable periods of time can humiliate the child and ruin the measure's effectiveness. Another counterpoint they make is that Dr. Diana Baumrind of the Institute of Human Development at the University of California, Berkeley, conducted a decade-long study of families with children aged 3 to 9. And he found that parents employing a balanced discipline style of firm control and positive encouragement experienced the most favorable outcomes with their children. And then another point they make is that for very compliant children, milder forms of correction will suffice, and spanking may never be necessary. But again, it depends. And then they have a parent's guide, I think some excellent points on that. They have 9 points, which I don't want to take the time to go through, but very balanced. And they're put together by then a Cromwell medical doctor with input from psychologists, psychiatrists, and pediatricians. And again, there's a lot of good material on there to counterbalance some of the political correctness that is going around. But another clipping I have, this is also from Focus on the Family, and this is October 1996. Again, it shows a little bit how times have changed. The year is 1896. James is just 13. All day he has worked alongside his father, watched the way he held the hammer, copied the movement of the blow that forged the iron, and even shod two horses himself. As James lifts his head and gazes out across the field, he sees his best friend walking beside his father as they plow together. For as long as anybody in the village can remember, the blacksmith shop and the farm have been there. Generations of fathers have passed their ancient skills to their children. And as they work side by side with their sons, they taught them things deeper than ironwork or the way to turn a horse at the edge of the field. They led them week by week over the years into manhood. Now the year is 1996, and James is 13. The modern James will not spend time at his father's side today. His father left the house before James woke up, and James will be at school all day. On the way home, he stops for his piano lesson. As soon as he got home, he turns on the television and sits glued to entertain himself and to be educated from the television. By the time James goes to bed, he will have learned from a multitude of teachers, both human and electronic. Some will have told him facts about the world that he lives in, and others will have conveyed their feelings. Entwined in a geography will be the question of why people in Ethiopia are hungry. Alongside this, the science will be the big question of where does it all come from? And in religious studies, the issue is raised as to what is really important in life. Others will have either tuned or dulled his ear to great music, molded his mind to politics, and taught a sexual ethic and helped create a man. At 8 p.m., he will, for the first time that day, meet his father. And his father will say, "What did you learn today, son?" And the 13-year-old boy will give the universal answer, "Oh, nothing." Remember that? And then in the same article, this is actually entitled, "Don't Delegate This One," and the author is Rob Parsons. In the same article, he says, "I was at a friend's home when their new kitten was brought home. The three children were incredibly excited, including 4-year-old Rebecca. Before their father released the kitten from the safety of the basket, he carefully explained the house rules with regard to the new occupant. You may pet the cat on his back and tickle his chin. If you are careful, you can pet it on his tummy, and as long as you are gentle, you can pick her up and cuddle her." At this point, the father's voice grew very solemn. "But," he said, "under no circumstances must you ever pull her tail. Do you understand all that?" Three small heads nodded in agreement. The cat was lifted from out of the carrier, put on the floor. Immediately, Rebecca took three strides toward it and grabbed its tail. She then turned and smiled at her father before the dazed parents could move, yanked for all that she was worth. In essence, Rebecca was saying, "You have given me rules, and I understand them, but I decided to test you by breaking them and crossing the boundary. What are you going to do about it?" It was vital that she be not disappointed. She was not. The discipline was swift and sure. One minute, Rebecca was testing her father. The next, she was staring at the ceiling of her bedroom. She could hear the noise of the laughter downstairs as the others were playing with the kitten. But she was not a part of the fun. Rebecca came downstairs an hour later with a fresh respect for her father and for the kitten. It's a learning experience. The issue of discipline is a contentious one, and every parent has to make ultimately decide which form to take. Okay? It is vital that discipline takes place. Nothing creates insecurity in a child more than the child believing there are no boundaries, and even if there are, that nobody really cares if they cross them. The constant question needs to be, is this a situation worth doing battle over? Parents always struggle with that. When loving discipline will cement a relationship, unjust or sharp criticism will kill it. Many a father has wished he had not started World War III over the color of a pair of jeans, or when there are so many more important battles to fight. This is how one father described a battle he wished he had never entered. He said, "My daughter came home one evening with bright orange hair. I hit the roof. My first thought was, what will people think of us? I told her she would never look like that under my roof and to change it. She refused, and I was left with either backing down or making her leave. We didn't speak for a month. We're fine together now, but I almost lost my daughter over some stupid hair dye." He said, very few people enjoy confrontation, but in a father-child relationship, three elements can assure that if confrontation has to happen, it has the potential to be productive. And then he ends off the article by saying, remember how fragile the self-esteem of a child can be? I read a scripture about not provoking your children to wrath. Forgiveness is a very important aspect. And vulnerability. Children need to know that their parents sometimes are wrong. I once heard a father boast, I have never, nor would I ever apologize to my son. We all make mistakes. And I think apology goes a long way. If as parents, we sometimes make mistakes. We're a church. We're a church family. And we meet together on a regular basis. And even in that welcome packet that is handed out now, I noticed that there is one sheet in there that has to do with etiquette for services. You know, when you come to God's house, we're told to walk prudently when you come to the house of God. In Ecclesiastes 5:1, keep your foot, it says. Or as the New Living Translation says, as you enter God's house, keep your ears open and your mouth shut. show respect. But it concerns two aspects, even with children. Children are a great blessing. However, parents should focus on the need to train their children to sit or to be occupied quietly during a service. It takes effort, it takes work, it takes patience. If a child is being noisy, as parents, we should remove the child from the hall, then tend to his or her needs. But also it has a section, congregation's response. On the other hand, as parents are working with their small children, we should show patience and support for them. It's tough. Everybody tries to do their best to create a good environment, a home environment. Doug Horchek had an article in United News, November 2005, Our Children and Sabbath Services. And he introduced his article by saying, it's 2:45 on a Sabbath afternoon. Services began 15 minutes ago, and a sermonette just started. I'm rocking my little Sally to sleep while my son Timmy gets settled by Dad on the floor with some Legos. Then it happens. The toddler, two rows down, begins to cry. The crying and screaming continues and gets louder while the mother tries to reason with her child to calm down. Then my little one awakes in a tearful moans due to the noise and the distraction. The cycling of crying toddlers and infants waking begins to unfold once again. She says, ah. And does that sound familiar? It happens, kind of a domino effect. So in his particular article, he mentions some helpful hints. He said, since the very nature of Sabbath service is different from being at a daycare or a playgroup, it will take some diligence on the parents' part in training and instruction to keep their to help their children learn how to behave so that they can show respect for God and others' services and get more out of Sabbath services themselves. And some of the things that he suggests in that article is teach your children about the uniqueness and special nature of the Sabbath service. Teach them that their behavior and playing while a service should be different, quieter, and more controlled than other days of the week. Teach them that mommy and daddy are at church services to learn, to sing hymns, and to let God know how much we appreciate and love him. Teach them the church is for them also, that God wants them to pray, to sing, to learn, and to worship him on that day as well. And he said one of the biggest frustrations for young parents is striving to teach their children to act and behave in a manner that is very different from their routine the other 6 days of the week. And what he recommends, rightfully so, is work toward consistency, especially in sleep times for small children. And ideally, if you can plan their sleep time for around the time of Sabbath services, they'll be sleeping the rest of their lives in church. Joke. Then it becomes a challenge later on. Also, regarding mother's room, we're blessed here. We have a beautiful mother's room with one-way glass. I don't know. I'm not sure if there's sound in there. Oh, great. Yeah. Oh, what a blessing. This is, I think, the only church I've ever pastored that has had such a blessing. But again, we're encouraged to use that to a minimum as you need it. Not a place just to hang out every week. Many years ago, I heard a wise grandfather who was also a church pastor in God's church. He gave this advice to all of the young parents in the congregation. Here's his advice, short but sweet. Work with your children 6 days, and they will give you rest on the Sabbath. Sound advice. They're anxious to burn off energy afterwards. We should resist the temptation to allow our children to begin running circles around the brethren and scooting cars and trucks in the aisles, middle of the aisles, and spilling coffee and running into seniors and tripping them. Kids will be kids. They have energy. But just going with the flow and letting your children's lives just happen is not the way to model behavior that will make the Sabbath special or a blessing. All of us, he said at the conclusion, all of us in the local congregation need to be loving and patient with one another. This includes patience with the parents who are teaching and training their precious little ones. Rather than criticizing or judging, offering to help a single mother or a parent who has small children while at church can be a real service, an example of love. You know, we have some congregations, a single mother, one congregation, two lively kids, or is it three, all by herself, and to get them all settled, pretty tough. Also, we've had discussions over the years, and it's been preached in the church, Proverbs 22, chapter 22 and verse 6, about train a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. I think, hopefully we understand this verse right. That is not, if you take this verse literally and say, if you do everything right as a parent, your children are going to be converted. That becomes a religion of works. It's no longer faith-based or based on God's calling. It's simply our work as parents. And if we do a good job as parents, then our kids are going to be living God's way the rest of their lives. It's not what this means. Frustrated parents often say, I did everything that the Bible told me to do. I trained my child in the way they should go, but what went wrong? Don't forget, God has to call John chapter 6 and verse 44. Question, is Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6 a divine universal promise that will convert our sons and daughters without any consideration of their freedom to choose? Not so. In Sansino, the Jewish commentary, that's actually really good for Proverbs, they go through Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6 rightfully. From the verb is derived the Hebrew word for educate. You know, train up or educate a child in a way that he should go. The intention is not a way of uprightness and good living, you know, which is a part of as far as moral education, but for the way in which he has spent his life. Whatever occupation he is to later to follow, it is necessary to prepare them in their early years, because then the habits are formed which influence their conduct into adulthood. Usually by age 5, a lot of that happens. It seems clear that the emphasis in Proverbs 22 and verse 6 is vocational and educational rather than spiritual. It is more a career emphasis with a guarantee than a guarantee of conversion. And you see the bent of your children. You know, if they're bent in a certain area, a certain direction, certain talents, you kind of work toward that. They're talented musically, you know, you do all you can to get them trained that way. They're talented with their hands, you find ways to develop that, and vice versa. Proverbs 22:6 is a reflective summary statement. It is not intended to be an absolute guide to living that is universally applicable to all situations that believers find themselves in. Question, is Proverbs 22:6 a law or a principle? Does Proverbs 22:6 carry the weight of an ironclad law of the universe with as much binding force as do the Ten Commandments? The answer is no. Proverbs 22:6 is an evaluation of a principle, not a law. And I'm taking that actually from Reviews You Can Use. That goes back to one of the ministerial journals that we've had. I think as you get into parenting, probably the single most important factor in parenting is personal example. Personal example. And I have some material here. This is again from Focus on the Family, August 1996. And the author is John Maxwell. And he wrote a piece entitled, Teach Your Children Well, Principles to Stand On. He said, the most important education I received from my parents was their modeling. They lived what they taught every day of their lives. He said, I know that I would not be where I am today if it were not for the love, the encouragement, and the teaching of my parents. Not long ago, I asked them, the parents, to list the top 10 principles that they wanted to teach my brother, sister, and myself as we were growing up. And he lists them. Responsibility, number one. Pick up your toys, put them away. Wash the dishes. Sounds like back in the 50s again, right? Well, responsibility. Work ethic, number two. We were required to do our homework before we played. We also learned that as we got older, we were to work more and to play less. Number three, determination. It helped me to keep me going when my responsibilities sometimes seemed overwhelming. His dad's favorite saying was from Abraham Lincoln, always bear in mind that your own resolution to succeed is more important than any one thing. Attitude. A positive attitude they learned from their parents. Their parents were not negative. They caught his dad reading The Power of Positive Thinking. He said, "What are you doing, Dad? You're already positive." His dad says, "Well, I don't want to slip up and fall into negative thinking, especially at my age." Potential, number five. My parents practice what it says in Colossians 3:21, which says, "Parents, don't come down too hard on your children, or you will crush their spirit." They constantly built us up, encouraged us, and instilled in us a desire to reach our potential. Relationships. My parents put relationships at the top of their list of priorities. They modeled a good relationship with one another and with other people around them. And then stewardship. It says, we were told as children that everything we had belonged to God and that our job was to faithfully take care of what he gave to us. Honesty. It says, I could count on them to be honest with me about anything. Generosity. Mom and Dad were always giving and expecting nothing in return. And dependence on God, number 10. It says, the final and most important principle taught to me by my parents was dependence on God. Cast your cares on the Lord, my mother used to say, and he will sustain you. He will not let the righteous fall. Dr. Hay once, I was in Sacramento, California, and he gave a sermon on child rearing. And this was the whole premise of his child rearing sermon. He says, example in child rearing is tremendously important. Because of bad example, discipline has to be overemphasized. We need to talk the talk. Or some people, he said, talk the talk, but do not walk the walk. And he emphasized that love is of paramount importance. Love first of all. Love without a good example is not love. Love has to be more than something that's indulging. And then he went on in the sermon. He actually talked about Deuteronomy 28, how you will conceive and not bring forth. Talks about abortion, which is, you know, a modern-day plague. But he talked about latchkey children, which is a challenge. We didn't have that in the 50s. No mothers at home. Children get home, and they basically entertain themselves. He encouraged adults to have your children around in your company. You'll learn more. I remember as a boy growing up, I really enjoyed my parents had company, adult company. I would just sit quietly and listen to them. And man, you can learn a lot. My dad always tried to include me in around adults. He said, offer quality time to your children when they're young. This will save time having to reparent them in the future. He encouraged your children to bring their friends over to your place, to their place. And he said the real work has to be done in the earliest years. That's when you're building the foundation. Teach them table manners. He said God put Adam and Eve in the garden. He didn't put them in a condo or an apartment. Nowadays, man surrounds himself with cement, asphalt, elevators. He said it's psychologically damaging. Kids should be able to get their hands in the dirt. Home should be an extension of the garden. He encouraged parents to read books on nutrition, gardening, etiquette, housework, and the Bible. At that time, he says 74% of black children under the age of 6 lived with one parent. He suggests you have a family photo album. Keeps a chronology of the family. Kids really enjoy, I know especially Sonia, every time she comes to visit us, she enjoys going through all the old pictures because you tend to forget things. And he said, discipline is far less necessary when proper instruction and proper example and proper love have been shown. This is also interesting. I'm getting near the end here. This is also very interesting. This is written by a high school teacher entitled, Hey, Mom and Dad. And again, this is from Focus on the Family, January 1997. He said, our society has gone overboard with the blame someone else syndrome. Nobody wants to accept responsibility for his or her behavior. Parents sometimes fail in how they relate to their children. Then I thought to myself, he said, what advice would teenagers give to their parents? What do they believe it takes to produce respectful and respectable teenagers? With generous help of two school districts, I surveyed more than 300 teenagers. It was like opening up a floodgate. He said some of the answers actually made him cry. Here are some of the outstanding answers that came to him. Advice from teenagers to their parents. Don't allow your child to bring company into the house unless you know them personally. That's from a 16-year-old African-American female. Don't let your small kids watch a lot of TV. If you do, they will adapt the bad attitudes they see on TV and not end up respecting you. 17-year-old Asian-American female. Teach your children about God. Try to raise them according to the principles found in the Bible. That's from a 17-year-old white male. When trying to talk to your children about private subjects like sex, just sensitively say it. If you beat around the bush, it makes you both nervous. A 15-year-old Hispanic male. Punishment should match the offense. That means physical punishment may be needed. That's from a 15-year-old Hispanic male. Look for things that are good about your children instead of constantly finding ways to put them down. That's from a 13-year-old ethnic Hawaiian male. Be consistent in what you say. Follow through with your decisions. 15-year-old female. Cook for your family. 17-year-old white female who says her mother never cooks except on holidays. Don't curse or smoke unless you want your children to do the same. A 16-year-old Hispanic female. When you let your children go out, give them a curfew. Let them know you love them and want them to be safe. 16-year-old Hispanic female. Play with your kids. Have fun and laugh. 15-year-old female. Fathers, tell your daughters that you love her often. If you don't, she will go out looking for love in boys or friends, but she will never find the kind of love she wants. That's from a 15-year-old Hispanic female. Don't tell your children the things they do are stupid. 15-year-old white male. Teach kids to take care of their things and to look out for their siblings. 15-year-old African-American male. Accept the fact that adults are not always right. If you're wrong, admit it. 15-year-old Asian-American female. Don't put too much pressure on your kids to excel. Understand they are young. They need to enjoy life. 14-year-old Asian-American female. Teach your children that a true friend will understand that when you say no, you mean no. 15-year-old white female. Don't hold the past against your child. What happened, happened. It can be changed. 18-year-old white male. Your daughter tells you she is not having sex, believe her. 17-year-old white female. Guide your children toward good marriages by giving them a good example to follow. 15-year-old Hispanic female. Sit down with your children and just talk. Ask them questions like, How was your school? How did you make any new friends? 16-year-old Hispanic male. Don't jump to conclusions. 15-year-old white female. Praise your children often. When you tell the truth, when they tell the truth, when they make good grades, when they look nice, praise them. 15-year-old Hispanic female. Turn the TV off and talk to your children. You can't carry on a good conversation if you're constantly worried about your show. 16-year-old white female who says her mom knows TV guide backwards and forwards, but has trouble remembering her family's birthdays. When your children are very small, let them have only wholesome friends. If you allow your children to have bad friends, they will soon be bad also. 16-year-old Hispanic male. Get involved in school activities. Acting concern is not enough. You need to show your concern by getting involved. 15-year-old white female. Try not to scold your kids in front of their friends. 15-year-old Hispanic female. No matter what your children go through, stay by their side. You don't have to agree with them. Just always support them. 15-year-old African-American male. If your child tells you something wrong is going on, believe him. Don't ignore your child. 16-year-old white male. Let your children grow up. 16-year-old female. Take your children to church. 15-year-old African-American male. Be there for teens, even when they try to push you away. The harder they resist, the more you need them. 14-year-old white female. Never force your child to choose one parent over the other. 15-year-old male. Know how to take control. Don't be a pushover. 16-year-old Hispanic female. Don't make your child call a step-parent mom or dad. 16-year-old female. Teach your kids manners, like how a lady sits, how a gentleman opens the door for a lady. 16-year-old white female. Introduce your children to extra activities. 17-year-old African-American female. Teach your children right and wrong, and that each action brings either a bad consequence or a reward. When they do that, reward them. When they do wrong, punish them. And that's from an 18-year-old Hispanic male. Again, some excellent points from teenagers. And some of them are pretty blunt, I thought, anyway. I have, as I said, there's so much resources available nowadays. Over the years, we've kind of built up a fair amount of books on the subject in my own personal library. But, you know, sometimes it might be good to pick up a book on parenting. This just came in the mail. This is this is not a promo for it. I have no idea, but Dr. Tim Kimmel, he's well-respected, focused on a family. Parenting Matters is now coming to the following cities this spring, April 15th, right here in Calgary. Parenting Matters. There are resource materials available. There are classes you can even take. Parenting is heart work. Parenting with Purpose and Grace. Parenting by Grace. Becoming the Parent God Wants You to Be, Raising Great Kids, Raising Kids Who Turn Out Right, those are video classes, Parenting 101, that's by Tim Kimmel again, Grandparenthood, More Than Rocking Chairs, Nurturing God's Way. Then there's a plethora of books. And if you're going to get one book, if you don't have it, this was recommended years ago, but It's small, but it hits the nail on the head. 132 pages, How to Really Love Your Child. And that's by Dr. Ross Campbell, How to Really Love Your Child. He has also another one, How to Really Love Your Teenager. And I'll just give you, I got a few more minutes here. He says, a child is the most needy person in our society, and his greatest need is love. And then he goes on to say, he said, most parents are not transmitting their own heartfelt love to their children, and the reason for that is that they do not know how. Unless parents have a basic love bond relationship with their child, everything else, discipline, peer relationship, school performance, is on a faulty foundation, and that problems will result. He said, this book provides the crucial basis for establishing a love bond relationship. Without a foundation of unconditional love, parenting is a confusing and a frustrating burden. What is unconditional love? Unconditional love is loving a child no matter what. No matter what the child looks like, no matter what his assets, liabilities, handicaps, no matter what we expect him or her to be, no matter how they act. This does not mean, of course, that we always like their behavior. Unconditional love means we love the child even when at times we may detest their behavior. A child's first impressions of this world are through their feelings. A child's emotional being determines how he sees his world, his parents, his home, himself. And he said the feeling of love for a child in our heart may be strong, but it is not enough. By our behavior, a child sees our love for them. Then he gets into the need for children to keep their emotional tank full. He said, another critical concept for parents to understand is that each child has an emotional tank. The tank is figurative, but very real. Each child has certain emotional needs, and whether these emotional needs are met through love, understanding, discipline, etc., determines many things. First of all, how a child feels, whether they are content, angry, depressed, or joyful. Secondly, it affects their behavior, whether they're obedient, disobedient, whiny, pesky, playful, or withdrawn. And the fuller the tank, the more positive the feelings, and the better the behavior. Only if the emotional tank is full can a child be expected to be at their best or to do their best. He said, let's understand that this tank has to be kept full and only the parents can really do it. Only if the tank is kept full can a child really be happy, how it can only reach their potential and respond appropriately to discipline. Children can be conceptualized as mirrors. They reflect but do not initiate love. If love is given to them, they return it. If none is given, they have none to return. Unconditional love is reflected unconditionally, and conditional love is reflected conditionally. He said, I find over and over again that the problem is parents do not know how to convey their love to their children. Actually, Dr. Campbell is a psychiatrist, well-respected in the area of working with young children. He said, conveying love to a child can be broadly classified in four areas. That's what the rest of the book has to do with. Eye contact, physical contact, focused attention, and discipline. He said, the area most overemphasized today to the exclusion of the rest, he said, is discipline. I see many children of Christian parents who are well-disciplined but feel unloved. In many of these cases, the parents have unfortunately confused discipline with punishment, as though the two were synonymous. Every day, I see the result of this approach to child rearing. These children are well-behaved, but they are quite young, although overly quiet, somewhat sullen, withdrawn. They lack spontaneity, curiosity, childish exuberance or a love-nurtured child. And these children usually become behavior problems as they approach and enter adolescence because they lack a strong emotional bond with their parents. And an excellent book, but at the end, he deals with discipline, I think in a balanced way, an appropriate way. But just one quote here, and I'll quit. He says, to depend on corporal punishment as the principal method of discipline is to make that critical error in assuming that discipline equals punishment. Discipline is training the child in the way that he should go. Punishment is only one part of that, and the less the better. Please remember this statement: the better disciplined a child is, the less punishment will be required. And he deals with that at the end for a couple of chapters. So I thought, again, he gives a balanced approach. But again, the Bible, you know, we all make mistakes. Nobody does a perfect job in any relationship. But one thing that overrides that, the Bible talks about that in Proverbs 10 and verse 12, is that love covers all sin. Love will cover a lot of our mistakes. There are plenty. I didn't even list all the resources. I got tons of resources. You can find them on the internet once in a while, just to keep honing our own skills as far as parenting, grandparenting. It's all, every stage we go through is always new to us, isn't it? Have your children, it's all new, brand new experience. And then by the time they're left home, you figure, well, you know, maybe I would know how to, if I had to do it all over again, I'd probably do a better job now, but it's too late. And then you get into grandparenting, and we only have one chance at that also. But again, it's still dealing with young minds. So, and again, the importance of this is, I had a concluding scripture, we've heard it many times, but our home life, our relationship with our children is very important, because the concluding scripture, Malachi chapter 4, I think we're familiar with it, verses 5 and 6. Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. He said, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." Family relationships are a part of setting things on track. And in our 21st century, there's a lot that does need to be set on track in our society. And certainly, I pray that that Elijah will come soon. So have a good remainder of the Sabbath, and see you in a couple of weeks' time.